We gather, whether we gather this way or other ways, we gather gratefully on land that at some point became known as Treaty One, and was cared for and stewarded long before that by the peoples of this continent, the first peoples of this continent. And so we're glad to be able to gather here and grateful for the welcome. You know that saying, we see what we're looking for? We've talked about that a little bit before in this space. I suspect that if there's a continuum to that idea, like if there's a variety of experiences of it, if there are people that are more or less prone to seeing what they're looking for, that I'm more over on the prone to, and for sure. Between having the present tense be my preferred time frame and being, you know, perennially distracted by ideas, I am always finding things that are more interesting than the thing that I probably should be, and maybe even, you know, actually was planning to be doing. And so that's the downside. I mean, that and the sometimes chaos I cause by just not paying enough attention to things like plans and schedules. But I can also say, I think without being defensive, that sometimes when you move through the world this way, it's pretty marvelous what you see. Especially if you are looking for things that are good, for things that are lovely, for things that are about, in this case, happiness and joy. I felt a little bit guilty / ridiculous / other kinds of things about doing a series on the pursuit of happiness under the current circumstances. Locally, globally, you know, historically. Can feel trite, at least as a sentence. And so I know that personally what I've been trying to do is come at this as realistically as I can. And that's taken us to some interesting places. The fact that we started with grief in a series about the pursuit of happiness feels to me like it springs from that intent. But I do find myself going through the world looking for things that are about happiness and joy in a different way. And that's not unusual for me. When we're in a topical exploration like this, I tend to have my radar on high for whatever pertains to it. I had some friends that Karina and I were having lunch with not that long ago, and one of them said, "How do you keep coming up with ideas?" Like every week. And these are people that have known us for decades, and so know that I've sort of been exploring belief for decades, kind of weekly, you know, in this sort of format. And like, how do you do that? Like, where do those ideas come from? And I thought about that for a minute, and I realized, like, a huge part of the answer is just what I said. We see what we're looking for. And that one significant influence on what I'm looking for every day is what I'm thinking about. And what I'm thinking about is often deeply informed by what I'm hoping to be able to offer as a catalyst for this community every week. So those things all play together. And sometimes, in what can feel like a bit of a universe balancing itself out moment, sometimes it seems like that the very community that I'm thinking about and watching for things on behalf of, that's exactly the community that hands me those things. And I've got three, four examples of that from these past few days, and they all, I think, play pretty nicely together, and they point us toward a common and, I think, I hope, helpful bit of insight. I want to start with a poem from one of the poets in our midst. Karen, I didn't ask for your permission for this one. You post them publicly, so I feel a certain sense of freedom. I hope, okay, got a thumbs up. That's good. Because if you don't, I'm just going to say, I had this great poem from Karen, I don't have permission to share it, and I would carry on. But Karen, who writes poetry under, you know, as some poets have done historically, under another name, but related to, you know, the name we know her by, your poetry, Karen, is a constant source of, I'm going to start with amusement because there's a wit in it that I really enjoy, but also reflection and inspiration for me. And quite a while ago, correct me if my memory is not serving me well here, but quite a while ago, you made a commitment to like write every day, right? A year and a half ago. And have there been any misses?
A few, I think less than.
Yeah, when I think about your posting frequency, I'm like, I don't know, like, what would it take? You know, you don't have to answer that, but, like, it's, you know, like, there haven't been misses. Like, it's just been this incredible output, absolutely remarkable. And to my great delight, personally, Karen doesn't just write every day, but writes well every day. And so it's been really awesome. It's pretty fantastic. So I've always got my eyes open for your next poem. And here's one from October the 18th that feels to me like it can carry us right into our breathing time and into our exploration after that. So just listen to this. Let it soak into you. Karen, I don't know how you feel about your poetry, but I often feel with poetry that it's incomplete until we hear it. You know, it needs to be out loud. And this one gets to be that way for us this morning. So I'll read it twice and just kind of like, won't put it up on the screen, but we'll just let it land wherever it lands. So listen to this. Restore the joy of rest, untouched by guilt. A brazen yawn, uncovered, naked, an increasingly inward quiet, wafting into silence. Be taken away. One more pass here. Restore the joy of rest, untouched by guilt. A brazen yawn, uncovered, naked, an increasingly inward quiet, wafting into silence. Be taken away. Thank you, Karen, for the reminder that there can be something truly joyful about rest. That intersection in the opening lines of that poem, Restore the Joy of Rest, just felt like the best sort of getting clobbered for me. But we have to let it be, don't we, for that to happen. We have to actually let rest be, let it be a thing, and we have to be open to the possibility that it could be about joy. It could be a joyful thing, a not guilty thing in our lives that opens, as Karen talks about in the poem, that can deepen if we'll let it be. Pretty beautiful thought. So we're going to take a few moments and just let it be. We've already kind of made the decision to be together, to set the time aside. And so if you are someone, don't raise your hand, but if you're someone for whom rest feels like it's guilty, you know, I think lots of us would have our hand up. Man, there's so many boxes you could check to just rest right now in the next few moments and not feel guilty. There's just so many good rationale for that. So let's just do it. Let's breathe together again as you wish and participate as you're comfortable. I'm going to do a simpler version of, we've sometimes done square breathing here. This will be box breathing. So we'll complete the box in the sense that in for a count of four, breathe in through your nose, fill yourself right up, cradle your breath for a count of four, exhale for a count of four, pursed lips. So there's some resistance. Our bodies, somehow that says to our bodies, you're in control of this exhale, as opposed to getting the breath knocked out of you. So that's an important signal. And then at the bottom of that cycle, just be empty of breath for a count of four before you breathe in again. So all the way around the box. And we'll do three of those together, and then we'll carry on with our exploration, okay? If you're listening to this later on the podcast, I'll leave the breathing in, which is not something I usually do when I edit the podcast because, you know, dead air. But this feels like a really important intersection in what we're doing together this morning. So if you're not practicing that or it doesn't fit wherever you're listening to the podcast, just fast forward it. Here we go. our bodies are hard to trick, right? Like they tell us the truth. And it doesn't matter how long that's been my practice. Every time I do it, if I'm standing or sitting as opposed to prone, my body sends me a signal that's very consistent, which is that my shoulders come down. The tension just starts to go out of this part of my body that I didn't even know was there. And so there's just lots of good reasons to stop and breathe. A couple of weeks ago, I got an email from somebody that's pretty new to the community as far as being in the room goes, but somebody who's been listening to the podcast for quite a while. And he sent a message that started with this sentence: "I have to believe that we are reading the same book." And he went on to correctly name the author in the book that I mentioned in the talkie bit last week. This person's book about happiness that I've been reading. I really enjoy experiences like that. I feel as though they're reminders of one of the truly beautiful aspects of a community of exploration, which is that it can bring together people who are poking around in their beliefs independent of one another. We're sort of all doing this work on our own, but who choose to show up in some way or other to do it together and then discover that not just generally, but sometimes very specifically, they've got company. That's pretty great. Like that's a pretty lovely thing. And among the other results, I think, of that kind of an experience is that it can really dial down the loneliness and it can really dial up the joy. You know, when we're taking apart our systems of belief, when we're kind of rummaging around in the places where we might have stored the things that were handed to us as true or unchanging or non-negotiable, and we're dragging those things out of their storage spaces in our lives to be examined, and we're discovering that some of them don't match any of those descriptions for us. When we're having experiences like that, it's pretty easy to start to feel like we must be the only person that's doing this. Like it's pretty easy to feel alone in that. And that can be especially true if we've grown up in communities where shared belief was one of the boundary markers for who was in and who wasn't. Because if shared beliefs are what kept you belonging and your beliefs start to shift, then it's sort of a short step to feeling like you're on the brink of, or maybe you're in the midst of, becoming some version of an outsider. And for almost anyone, that kind of an experience can stir up the sensation of being alone or the fear of being shunned or at least treated with some suspicion. In my personal experience, it can lead to being treated like you just ceased to exist in terms of community. One of the most staggering parts of my own journey of shifting beliefs is just how thoroughly communities that proclaim everyone is welcome can gaslight people whose journey takes them outside of whatever those key markers of right belief might be in that context. And I think there's probably lots of reasons for that, but I think really a significant one in terms of human experience is fear. Fear and not having been equipped to know how to handle that, not being equipped to know what to do with that. I'm not trying to let all of our bad behavior off the hook, but I think there are some reasons like that that are common. So even though I know, deeply and personally know, that the thought, if you keep going down the path of exploration, you'll end up alone, is a lie, I know that's not a true statement, I still find it delightfully affirming and reassuring to get an email like that one and to be reminded that I am, that you are, that we are not alone when it comes to exploring what we believe. That we've got company. And here's an aspect of that experience that I find especially important. I don't know how it felt to that person to send that email. We haven't talked about that. We haven't had occasion to. But I do know that if I sent it, there would be a part of me that would be feeling a little bit vulnerable. You might recall that in the talkie bit last week, I quoted C.S. Lewis as saying that friendship has to be about something, even if it's white mice or dominoes. Every time I see that quote, I'm like, why those, Mr. Lewis? But anyway, as we talked about, putting something that we like, something that makes us happy out there for others to be aware of, to invite someone to maybe join us in that joy, that's a vulnerable action. We're taking a chance when we do that. We're taking something that is connected to joy for us and we're offering it for someone else's consideration. And what if they don't like it? What if they take offense? What if they think we're shallow or naive or insensitive or whatever it is that we fear to be into whatever it is that we've confessed makes us happy? Because we're a varied bunch. And there are some of the things that make us happy are just like, they're quite a surprise, you know? I was with a group of Montessori educators recently, and we were doing a little exercise together about what we have in common. And, like, not me with them, but them with one another as colleagues. And I won't take a lot of time on this story, but just a quick visual. It was in a Montessori classroom. There are no big chairs and high tables in Montessori classrooms. And so it's this whole room full of adult educators, you know, sitting, like, this far off the floor, which just made me happy, like, right out of the gate. But anyway, this one group of people who, you know, these are people who take their work seriously. That's why we were doing this thing together. And what they had in common was they all liked, like, the most generic sorts of action films. It's like, you know, so you just never know, right? And one of them in the group said, what's the funniest or most curious all-in-common thing you've ever come across in this kind of a setting, a workshop like this? And I didn't have to think very long. It was actually a large workshop. There was like over 100 people in this workshop, and we did the same exercise at rounds of eight, right? It's a huge variety of people. And this particular table, they were all social workers except their financial officer, who was like one of the only guys in the room as well. And he was at this one table. What they all had in common, what they all liked, what brought them all joy, I don't even know how they got there in terms of process, was baby goats. Like, I didn't even have to try to remember that to answer the question. It was just like, that was so, huh. And to me, that's, in this context, to me, that's a story about that happy surprise, right? Like, if we weren't doing an exercise like that, we would have never, those group, that they would have never known that at the end of this long day together, working hard, they were, some of them were going home to, like, their group of baby goats. Then they were just stoked. You just never know, right? But that's vulnerable. Like, to put that out there and go, I don't know if there's anybody else in the world that really kind of, like, digs baby goats, but that'd be me. You know, that we feel all kinds of feels when we do that. So that feels like a little bit of a dilemma, right? It's hard to have or to initiate or to explore the possibility of friendship or connection and the joy that can go with that without some vulnerability. And they're kind of just connected. Earlier in this series, I mentioned a book that Justin recently lent me called The Happiest Man on Earth, The Beautiful Life of an Auschwitz Survivor. And the inside flyleaf of that book has a well-known quote in it that says, "Don't walk behind me, I may not lead. Don't walk in front of me, I may not follow. Just walk beside me and be my friend." It's credited to Anonymous in the book, which might just mean it doesn't have a clear genesis as an idea, but I think we resonate with it, right? All the chapters in the book have sort of these little titles of some sort. And chapter 6 is titled, "One Good Friend is My Whole World." And in that chapter, Eddie, the author of the book, tells the part of the story of his friendship with a guy named Kurt and how profoundly important that was during his time and Kurt's time as well in Auschwitz, in a death camp. And I want to read us just a couple of excerpts from that chapter. So he's talking about what the experience of being processed into Auschwitz is like. "Suddenly, I had lost everything. My family, my possessions, my remaining faith in humanity. I was allowed to keep only my belt, my one memento of a life I would never see again. As people came into Auschwitz, the Nazis would confiscate everything they owned and take it to a special area to be sorted by Jewish slave laborers. We prisoners called this area Canada, with a K." And then he goes on to say, "as Canada, with a C, was seen as a beautiful place where all the good things in life, food, money, jewelry, were available in surplus. Everything I owned was stolen and sent to Canada. Worst of all, my dignity was stripped from me. When Hitler had written his hateful book, Mein Kampf, in which he blamed all the troubles of the world on Jews, he had fantasized about a world in which we would be humiliated, eating like pigs, dressed in rags, the most pitiful people in the world. Now, that had come true." Then he goes on to talk about the number that's tattooed on his arm and what it felt like to become a gear in a great killing machine against his will. And he goes on in the middle section of this chapter to delineate some of the horrors of Auschwitz, and in particular of their living accommodations and what it took to try to just survive the night at 8 degrees below zero with other people who had no clothing at all, because if you're naked, you can't run away. And how the end person on the row, if you didn't change places often enough to cycle through and stay warm next to the person next to you, just froze to death. And that every night, 10 or 15 people just died because they didn't change places soon enough. So it's horrid. And so he talks about that. He talks about other things about their work in the middle of this. But I want to read you some of what he talks about in terms of how he survives this. Because that's the friendship part. He says it this way. I can tell you that I would not be here today without Kurt. Thanks to my friend, I survived. We looked after each other. When one of us was injured or too sick to work, the other would find food and help the other. We kept each other alive. The average survival time of a prisoner in Auschwitz was 7 months. Without Kurt, I wouldn't have made it half that far. When I had a sore throat, he cut his scarf in half and gave me one so I could recover. People saw us wearing the same scarf and assumed we were brothers. We were that close. These moments of friendship and gratitude were necessary in order to survive that inhumane place Hitler had created. Many people chose to take their own lives rather than go on. It was so common, there was even a phrase to describe it: go to the wire. Auschwitz II-Birkenau, a subcamp of the much larger Auschwitz camp complex, was surrounded by an electrified barbed wire fence. To touch this fence was certain death, and so to end their lives without giving the Nazis the satisfaction of killing them, people would run to the wire and grab it. I lost two good friends this way. They went, naked, holding hands, to the wire. I do not blame them. Certainly, there were many days I would have preferred to be dead. We were cold. We were sick. Many times I said to Kurt, let's go. What is the point of living only to suffer tomorrow? Kurt refused. He would not let me go to the wire. This is the most important thing I have ever learned. The greatest thing you will ever do is be loved by another person. I cannot emphasize this enough, especially to young people. Without friendship, a human being is lost. A friend is someone who reminds you to feel alive. Right. The people, Eddie, the people that Eddie talks about in that book, these are people who have been stripped of almost every vestige of what it means to be human. And yet, in the midst of that suffering, Eddie talks about ways they continued to share whatever joys there were to be found. I didn't single it out in what I read, but he makes a real point in that chapter sharing how important it was to just walk and talk, even if it was for a few moments a day, with his friend. And I cannot imagine what it would feel like to offer yourself as a friend when your sense of who you were was under that kind of attack, when you had so little self left, as he talks about at the beginning of that chapter, so little self left that if you offered it and it was rejected, that might be enough to take you to the wire. But Eddie and Kurt chose that anyway, and in this story, that's what kept them alive. Now, that might seem like a pretty grim illustration for an exploration of happiness, but happiness, or any other human condition or feeling, is just that universal, that powerful, and that fragile, all at the same time. Which brings me to the fourth gift that someone in this community handed me. We all have different ways of interacting, and there are a few folks at the table who like to send their thoughts my way following our times together. If I make a literary reference, I can almost count on Tim following it up with some further insight into whatever source I was working with. And another person in this community who does that pretty regularly is Misty. And this past week, Misty sent me a clip of an interview between Brené Brown, whose work I found very helpful and inspiring, and Oprah, who's like a towering figure in popular culture, but someone with whom I've had almost no intersection. I've never watched Oprah. So that was already interesting. I sort of had to suspend my innate reservations about, you know, people made super famous by media and just kind of lean into the clip. And just, you know, Misty sent this, so I'm going to check it out, right? Because I trust her, you know, and like, she wouldn't waste my time. And so, yes, it's Oprah, and I'm going to watch it. Sort of where I was starting. But in the clip, and I have nothing against Oprah, I just don't know. Just whatever. So in the clip, Oprah is asking Brené Brown to say more about her stated belief that the cultivation of gratitude and joy is what Brown calls the way home. in a particular book. And in the course of that conversation, Brené tells the story of how in 12 years of research, she has not encountered a single person who talks about truly experiencing joy who does not actively practice, deliberately cultivate gratitude. And she's told her team, she's made a personal commitment to them, I will never talk about joy without talking about gratitude. They are that inextricably linked. And I'm thinking as I'm watching this interview, I'm thinking, well, yes, and so far so familiar, at least as far as the connection between joy and gratitude goes. But then Brené kind of does a bit of a mic drop, and she says, if you asked me what the most terrifying, difficult emotion we experience as humans, I would say joy. Screeching brakes, right? You're like, no, the joy is good. Like, joy is lovely. Who doesn't want joy? What's terrifying about joy? And then she goes on to illustrate from a couple of common experiences where we feel like when things are going well, and the story that she opens with there is she's like, if you're a parent, have you ever had this moment where you're standing over your kid while they're sleeping and you're looking at them and you're thinking, like, I have never loved anybody like this. Just. And then in the exact same instant, almost you're like, is the roof going to fall? Like, what terrible thing is going to happen? You know? Like, how could this not be just followed by tragedy? And that's what she's talking about. When we're in the presence of really big love, in that instant, we find ourselves waiting for the shoe to drop, like for something truly awful to happen. And she explains that tendency by saying this. When we lose our tolerance for vulnerability, joy becomes foreboding. When we lose our tolerance for vulnerability, joy becomes foreboding. To put it another way, we're reluctant to open ourselves up to joy because we're afraid that it's going to be taken away. Short story, right? We hold ourselves back from joy as a kind of preemptive strike, as a way of protecting ourselves from the loss that we fear. But here's the kicker. When whatever it is that we fear comes to pass, holding ourselves back from joy is not going to protect us from how that feels. That's not how it works. In fact, it's more likely that we'll experience something like the opposite of that, that we'll find ourselves in that moment of loss or suffering, wishing we had opened our hearts and lives up more to those moments of joy. Because that's what we'll have. As Brown puts it, quote, we're trying to dress rehearse tragedy so we can beat vulnerability to the punch. The alternative, which she says she has heard over and over from joyful people, is when we feel that tendency to open to joy and we pull away from it, when we feel that tendency to retreat from happiness in order to protect ourselves from tragedy, that's exactly the moment to consciously practice gratitude. To cultivate it. Not an idea, a practice. To actually do it. Right there, right then. And you might have been tired of hearing this from me by now, but tough luck. I feel like this is up there right next to Love Matters Most when it comes to lessons I've learned from my mom. Somebody who knew lots about suffering and loss, and yet there was this well of joy in her that was replenished over and over by gratitude. That's what filled it back up. The fact that gratitude can be cultivated, that we can choose to open ourselves to moments of tenderness and friendship and connection and joy, that's why, that intersection, that's why I called this talkie bit, We Can Change That. That's what the title has to do with all of this. That belief that the twinge that we feel in our spirit when joy comes our way, that twinge of that we think is like a harbinger of tragedy, right there, we can change that. The suspicion that opening ourselves to connection, to friendship with another person is always and only a setup for disappointment, we can change that. That notion that exploring what we believe will make us some kind of community pariahs, we can change that. We can choose in those very moments of vulnerability to open our hearts and our minds and our lives to gratitude. One of the beliefs that I have retained in my own exploration of my beliefs is pinned to the refrain, give thanks. And if you grew up evangelical in a certain era and part of the world, you may remember a song, the refrain of which is give thanks with a grateful heart. Such a common song in those settings that I mean, it's not like I'm that special as a person, but I was like, is that a Bible verse or is that like a song lyric? Like, you know, what's the source of that phrase? Because it's very sticky, and it is a song lyric, but it's couched, of course, or drawn from a particular biblical text. And that text presents giving thanks as part of a cluster of behaviors that can help us connect with the divine, which is what the phrase in the Bible, "This is the will of God," actually means in wider terms. Right? It means this is a way to get past just what you see. Giving thanks is a way to get past just what we see. A way to change, to shift those things that we fear that cause us to close instead of opening to what is good and beautiful and lovely. It's another way of saying, cultivate gratitude. Losing touch with gratitude is one of the things that makes us pull back from happiness. But we can change that. Peace, everybody. Thus far, the reading of the talkie bit. I can always tell who grew up around the liturgy when I do that.